It's Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and me, Bill Teeple. Well, we came in here today to talk about photography. Only before we could even begin, Donna had to declare her obsession with the sea, and that we need some kind of resolution of this, the situation you've brought to us today. Tell us about it.
Yes, this is a kind of therapy session, I think, because for some reason I woke up this morning feeling an intense longing for the sea, which when you're living in the middle of Iowa is not an easy thing to fulfill, other than looking at pictures of the sea. And I actually looked in my closet when I was getting dressed this morning and put on essentially sea-colored clothing and my socks with shells on them, because this was like a deep thing. This was not just some fond memory of the seaside. It was, and it's still there. It's all day long. Now it is, you're listening to this early in the morning. We're recording this at 10 after 3 in the afternoon, and it's been all day that I'm feeling this longing for something. I don't really think it's even about going to the beach or something like that. I think it's something of the sea in me that I'm wanting to awaken or be in touch with. So
it's the naiads. They're singing to you.
Ah, yeah. Better watch out, huh? Well, it may have been sparked by last night when I was writing up the article for the Odd Thursday on the icons of romanticism, and which include The Wanderer by the Sea. I came across a painting by Caspar David Friedrich, one of the German romanticist artists, and it was of a lone figure standing on the rocks looking out at a misty sea. And it's a beautiful image to me, and that particular kind of seascape is my favorite kind, where there are rocks and the waves are crashing against and there's mist over everything. So it may have just been nothing but that simple image of that figure that I went to sleep on last night and then woke up this morning with the old 19th century romantics longing for stormy wilderness. I don't know.
Well, it sounds like Maine coastline, but I suppose it could be Big Sur.
Maine. Well, there are many rocky coastline. There's the coast. There's various places in Greece. Nova Scotia. There's Brittany. Yeah. There's Maine. Big Sur. They're all equally appealing to lovers of rocky coastlines.
However, I'm familiar with the soft, soothing qualities of the Southern California seashore and the Baja and Mexico and that kind of
white
thing.
White sand
beaches.
That's
another thing, yeah. That would relate to the Hawaii and the Florida type of thing, which is a whole other thing. That's much more tropical and fertile feelings and all of that. But the sea is this compelling thing. I mean, what is it that draws you to want to go stand by the ocean? Because coming from by the water, and I grew up literally 10 feet from the water,
really?
By a canal.
Oh, wow.
We lived on a canal that went into a bay that was separated from the sea by a peninsula. Hmm. So water, water, water. So I feel the same kind of like hung out to dry in Iowa. You couldn't be more like farther from the coast than we are here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So every now and then I have an attack myself. I've sort of just gotten used to that there's no edge to this place.
Mm-hmm.
But what is it when you're near the edge that draws you to go there? I mean, you want to just go to that meeting place between the land and the sea, and going on, it's completely renewing.
Well, the ocean is such a profoundly different thing from everything else. You know, it's infinite. You look at it and it stretches to the horizon in many directions, and if you're out in it on a boat, maybe all directions, there's nothing but sea and the sky. And at the same time, you know, being on the coast, you're looking at an interface of the world of detail and the known, and the world of you know, kind of undifferentiated something or other that is totally unknown. And then you think of the depths of the ocean, and it goes down as far or farther than the tallest mountains go up, and we barely know, even with modern technology, what's actually going on down there. You know, there are creatures that we see every once in a while, giant squid that must live out there in some populations, but we've only seen, you know, a handful of them in all of recorded history. And somewhere they're, you know, raising their families and swimming around doing their thing, and we just don't know about them.
So it's the mystery the deep.
It encapsulates all of the mystery and unknown and vastness of the extensions of our lives, which we don't normally think about, but the ocean opens that up to us.
And in modern times, we've learned, you know, that life began in the sea and emerged onto the land eventually. And so we may have some, you know, very, very subtle ancient primordial cellular connection with sea life.
Well, there's the other part, excuse me, the other part of the sea, besides its vastness and its mystery, that I absolutely love are the rhythms. Connection between the moon and the sea, and the hours of the day and the sea, and the tides coming in and out, and the winds
the sound
and the
of
sea.
The surf.
And, yeah, there's so many relationships that are taking place that are influencing this vast body of water and making it behave in different ways. And it's completely serenely surrendered to all of these influences and just, you know, dancing with all of these other influences in its own way.
Yeah. The sea is a in a sense, an opportunity for the planet Earth to remind us what a planet is, the scale of a planet. Mm. That there, you know, because you see the ocean and it's doing its thing, it's breathing, you know, the surf is never ending but never quite the same, and the weather patterns change everything, but it's still out there absolutely self-sufficient and absolutely uncontrollable and doing whatever it is that it does. And you know, it's kind of in your face. You have to accept the fact that, you know, next to the sea, you are just a little dot of consciousness perceiving the sea.
It's hugely powerful, too.
Yeah.
If you're ever out in it, and there's at all any waves going on, you realize how small you are and how infinitesimal and how huge and powerful. And yet, there's a kind of, like, controlled calmness over the whole thing, and yet at times it can like rise up in great fury.
Well, that's why in ancient Greece they always would appeal to Poseidon first, because Poseidon, the god of the sea, controlled their very destiny. You know, the sea gave them sustenance through the fish that they had to find enough fish to eat from the sea, and supported their boats when they would fish or go into battle or something. But in the split second, the sea could smash the boat to smithereens, and they would lose everything. And so Poseidon had to constantly be placated, and the temples to Poseidon are generally built on places, on bluffs overlooking the sea, that are very magical places that kind of have all of the different various qualities of the sea, the ocean, the waves coming in and rocks jutting up out of the sea, and this wide horizon and the seabirds. And one of my favorite sea memories was sitting at the Poseidon Temple in Sunion in Greece and watching a seabird who literally went from as far to my left as I could see to as far to my right as I could see without ever flapping its wings. Mm-hmm. It just, and it was like all doing this beautiful kind of calligraphic pattern in the air because of the currents, of the breeze, and the seabird was, and somehow it was almost like, because sitting in this ancient temple, it was almost like this was a ritual, you know, some deep, mysterious, religious ritual to the sea that this bird was doing for my benefit.
Well, it's a very minimalist statement, you know. There's not much. There's sky, there's sea, there's bird, and there's gliding. There isn't even any volitional action, really, except the subtle movements of the wings to ride the air currents.
What I don't, you're bringing up a lot of stuff here that I haven't really reflected on that consciously, actually. I just have accepted it because I grew up near the sea, but there is this feeling and flavor, it's absolutely strong and unique when you get near the sea culture. I mean, like where the land, the culture that takes place at the seashore. Now, this is not 1 mile inland. This is at the seashore. Yeah. You get within 100 feet of the sea or 200 feet or something, and suddenly you can smell the sea, you feel the thick sea air, you the breezes have all a certain feeling, and the stuff is, you know, all these, you know, usually the culture at the seashore has its own thing. First of all, the plants are very unique at the sea edge. It changes completely the kinds of plants. And then there's all the sea stuff, the shell stuff that has to do with shells and grottos and and just the sea businesses, the boat yards. I mean, it's because I grew up around all this, and it's just, I took it for granted. And yet when I got away from it, it's, you're suddenly like in the desert. The difference is like suddenly being in the Mojave Desert, while before you were in this place of lush moisture and
We always considered it to be a matter of being on the water or not. It's sort of like everything else is just not on the water. And in Maine, one of the wonderful things about Maine is that the coastline is so excruciatingly convoluted that you can drive 100 miles inland and still find that practically every house that you drive by has two or three boats, usually at least two of them are kind of falling apart, haven't been in the water in a long time, but there are fingers of water, you know, there are bays and going way, way, way into the mainland, and the bays themselves have inlets, and so practically every house is on the water. I mean, literally thousands of houses are on the water in a region. And yet, you know, if you drive on the road, you're not really on the water. If you pull into any one of the driveways, then suddenly you are, and the backyard isn't a yard, it's a dock. And people are doing things with the water, relating to the water.
That was my first experience of the ocean, was on the coast of Maine. My aunt and uncle lived up there and had a boat that they lived maybe 5 miles away from the ocean. And it was wonderful. I remember very vividly being quite small and being, when it would get rocky and we would be getting splashed on the deck of the boat and everybody would run down into the cabin, I would very stubbornly stay up with my uncle and, you know, hold on to something so that I wouldn't be washed off overboard. But it was something that fed me and nourished me even at that young age to be out, especially in a stormy, semi-stormy. It wasn't dangerously like we were going to drown kind of stormy, but it was rocky, and I just love that. And I think one of the things I love about the waves and the rocks, as opposed to the just pleasant little sandy beach, is even though the water is the softer of the two elements, it's the water that wears down the rocks and smooths the hard edges of the rocks. And when you find things along the beach, they're smooth. You know, pieces of glass that you find on a beach don't have edges that you cut your fingers on. They are smoothed and really interesting. Pieces of old crockery. It's even right now on my shelf in my bathroom, I have a collection of sea glass shells and old crockery that my son Dane and I found in tide pools in San Malo on the northern coast of Brittany in France. And it's actually on the English Channel, but the beaches there are very magical and very rocky and wonderful waves. And one day, it was actually one of the most magical days I think I've ever had in my life. The lighting was absolutely perfect that day. And Dane and I found a kind of sea cave that very few tourists, you had to like climb down some rocky bluff sort of thing to get there. And so it wasn't a place that tourists usually went. And we went down there and spent hours pouring through in detail the little tide pools in the sea cave and finding little tiny things to bring home with us. And that's what's on my shelf in my bathroom. And I look at it every day, but every once in a while, it literally makes me cry.
Yeah.
Because it takes me back to that day, which was one of those gifts from the gods, you know, days that you can't plan for. They just suddenly are bestowed upon you, and there you are in timelessness.
So. Which brings up another element to all of this, I think, that it's just longing itself. Mm. Like when you long for some one thing like the sea, I mean, that's what got you today. But I also think that there's a longing for the world. There's the love of the world. And artists just sort of like wring themselves out with this, because I think it's what artists do. I mean, some people I know just want to get out of here, get out of it, just escape the relative and merge or something with the absolute and just get it over with. But as an artist, I'm in love with every tiny detail of this creation. Mm. And so you can start, if you feel like it's slipping away or there was an experience that you want to get back, then there's this sort of aching longing. Mm-hmm. And somehow the sea thing seems to like symbolize and that whole thing.
Yeah.
But I think it's because the sea, and it represents that feminine side of the universe that draws the male into creation to animate the creation. Mm-hmm. And it's a fairly cosmic thing, I think we've raised today.
Yeah. Well, and the sea is also, you know, so deeply connected with coming and going and you know, emerging and disappearing. Even on the lake that, you know, I used to go to in Maine. It's a pretty good sized lake, and I remember standing on our island watching, you know, my parents or my brother or somebody going away in a boat. And they go away and they get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until you can't hear the motor anymore, and then you can't even see the boat anymore. And that's something almost unique to the water. I mean, it can happen in the desert, obviously, but it's been a tradition happening in the ocean. And the, you know, all the houses on all the old houses on the coast of New England have, you know, lookouts on the roofs where, you know, the wives would go up and scan the horizon looking for the sail that meant that their husband was coming home. Mm. Hopefully with fish or whatever, but at least coming home.
Yeah, and as you were talking, I also remembered lighthouses. I went through a phase of my life where I was absolutely obsessed with lighthouses, and I actually wanted to be a lighthouse keeper. And one thing that moved me more than anything I've ever seen on television, I was wandering into, someone else was watching the TV, and I happened to walk into the room, and it was a documentary on the fishermen of Brittany. And I walked into that room and I was like glued to those images. And one of the ones that stuck with me more than anything else was a lighthouse that was at least a mile out into the sea, because there were so many rocks on that coast that, you know, it's very dangerous waters. So out about a mile out into the sea, there was a lighthouse that was just been built on a piece of rock. And to get they went in groups of two, the lighthouse keepers, and to get into this lighthouse, they had to pull a boat up. The boat couldn't dock at this rock. It was some distance away, and there was some kind of a thing that was like a cable that came up from some pole that came out of the sea, and they had to be hoisted up onto that pole and then pulled over on a kind of pulley on a wire over the sea into the top of this lighthouse. And then the waves would crash as high as 20 feet up onto the sides of the lighthouse, and the water would like swirl around at the base of the lighthouse. And I was with the person that I was watching this with, I said, "Oh God, I would love to be one of those lighthouse keepers." And the guy looked at me like I was absolutely mad and said, "Are you kidding? Why would you want to do that?" And the fact that he even asked me why I would want to do that made me realize there was no way I was going to be able to explain why, because I didn't even know why. It's just that I wanted to be there and experience the ocean that completely around me like that without being on a boat, you know, just being up there in this lighthouse and gazing out in all directions at the sea.
Well, now, as a painter and illustrator and writer and novelist, what would you do about this longing? I mean, does it move you to paint or illustrate or novelize or essayize?
Well, I have actually. Not so much visual art, because it's very, very difficult to draw or paint the sea, because the sea is always moving. And, you know, it just, I've tried doing drawings of it, it doesn't work. But I did take a video camera on that trip to San Malo and other parts of Brittany that I went with my son, and I have a lot of footage of just waves. Some looking down from a bluff, with the camera pointing down into a little alcove where the waves would come in and swirl all around against the rocks and constantly changing their patterns. And I would stand there long periods of time with just holding my camera still. And even now, if I look at that footage, it's wonderful to me. I just love. In fact, that's what I ought to do today, is go home and look at that footage. Because that will take me back to that place at the sea. But in my novel that I've been writing for the last 4 or 5 years, the novel actually opens in Greece. The mother of the main character, it's backstory of the mother of the main character, she was born in Athens, but the critical part, which is actually sort of the seed of the whole novel, takes place on the island of Delos in Greece, which is an island that has the ruins of many old temples, and nobody lives on the island. It's just got these ruins.
It's the birthplace of Apollo.
Birthplace of Apollo, that's right. And so there's definitely a lot of water and rock imagery in the beginning of my novel and at a few other places throughout the book.
I guess in a way I was also asking whether you would be likely to have an artistic response to this longing that you woke up with today, or whether in a sense the longing is such a thing in its own right that there isn't really any way to
There was on a small scale an artistic response today, because I had to come here and do the radio shows, and so I couldn't spend all day doing this. But my first artistic response was putting these clothes on and getting dressed in clothes that were the colors of the sea. And then I did go through some, I have piles of magazines, and I went through some piles of magazines and actually cut out some pictures of the sea and water and rocks and everything, and I don't know what I'm going to do with these pictures, but I just kind of had 10 minutes before I had to come over here, and I just thought, I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to do now when I go home, I really can't say, but you're right, I do have a feeling that I need to do something. mm-hmm. creative, artistic, not so much creative actually as reflective or probing, you know, to go, I'd like to find out what exactly it is. I think it feels like something more than just being sparked by that picture of this wanderer by the sea last night. It feels like something that means something more than just the beach or the ocean. So I will do something. I don't know what exactly I will do when I go home, but.
When I was a little kid, I used to, I guess I was just learning to write creatively. And I used to write mostly scenes that were just atmospheres, that, you know, like what we're describing of the, you know, the rocky coastline of some place on the ocean. And I would just sort of climb into that environment, and more imagery would come out of my pencil point onto the paper. And I always wrote in those days with my head lying on the table next to the paper, watching the tip of the pencil and sort of marveling at how the words came out of the end of the pencil. And I couldn't quite tell how that happened, even though obviously I knew I was writing it. But I would write, you know, these long descriptions of life, just sort of a snapshot of being the size of an ant under a leaf on the jungle floor with everything green and rotting and dripping all around, and, you know, the leaf tilting a little bit from the water that accumulated on it from the dripping, or sitting in a snowbank in the Arctic with nothing to look at all, and I would still somehow find a way to, you know, write two or three pages about being in this blank white environment. And I guess I could imagine, you know, just starting to depict what's going on that rocky coastline in nature, and having it, you know, turn into a whole thing.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I haven't actually done free writing in a long time. I used to be in a writing group where we did free writing every week, but I haven't done that in a long time. But that's a good idea, to just see what story comes out if I just start writing about this longing for the sea.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.